In the great hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend and someone who knows a lot about writing the Super Friends themselves is our pal, Sholly Fish. Hi, Sholly.
Hello.
I'm so happy to have you on this show, finally.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure.
Okay. Oh, man. I mean, it said, I read DC Super Friends, which you wrote every single issue of back in the day. And, of course, this is sort of the early version of that. And so I've always wanted to have you on the show. So I am just super great that we finally talk about this issue, which has features a classic DC villain. It's going to be lots of fun stuff to talk about. But before we get to the issue specifically, which, of course, is going to be Super Friends number 32, what is your history, Sholly, with this series? Did you? I'm assuming you read it as a kid.
Yeah, so I did. So it was actually kind of interesting because since I'm a Sabbath observer, I could never watch Saturday morning TV. And so I could never see the cartoons, you know, when they were really on the air. And then, you know, often I would see them a couple of years later when they moved to Sundays or something like that. But Super Friends, that didn't happen for years. And I was dying to see this show. So what wound up happening was, you know, I couldn't watch the show, but I could read the comics. And it was a period when, you know, Justice League has always been one of my, it's actually the first comic I ever bought was an issue of Justice League of America. And this was one of those periods when Super Friends was actually consistently on a month-to-month basis better than the Justice League comic. And so I was reading this thing religiously every month.
So was it a book? Now, this is something I've been asking people month to month when I have a different guest, because, of course, you know, this is an era. Super Friends is a series wrapped up, as I said, in 1981. So that's just before comic shops, you know, comic specialty shops really took off. And so most people that read Super Friends were relying on newsstand distribution. And I found that a lot of people didn't see this book consistently. Some people, not at all. I've had a few guests on that are really? Like, it literally never showed up. So was this something you said, you know, you liked it more than Justice League does? Was it from when you can remember, like, did you get it every month? It showed up in your neighborhood consistently?
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, so let me think. So, yeah, late 70s, I was in high school. And it was right around then that, like you say, right around then that the direct market started up. And so I probably started off buying it at a newsstand, and then at some point when I was in high school, a comic shop opened up near school, and then I was able to get stuff much more reliably. So I don't think I missed an issue of it, actually.
Now, you kept reading it into high school? Because, I mean, I could see a lot of kids, once they were in high school, would be like, this is a little too, you know, kiddy for me.
No, because like I say, it was better than the Justice League comic. So, you know, it wasn't a great period for the Justice League comic, but notwithstanding. You know.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Oh man. So, okay. Well, I mean, we are going to talk a little bit about you writing the sort of sequel series, DC Super Friends, but we'll talk about that after we get to this individual issue. Sure. As I said, so this is number 32. It was on sale February 28th, 1980. The story is The Scarecrow Fights with Fear, which is really more of just of a statement, really, than a story title exactly. It's like, yeah, that's what he does. Before I get to the endless plot synopsis, sorry, everybody, I do want to ask you, what do you think of this cover by Kurt Schaffenberger and Bob Smith when you've got the Scarecrow in the center and he's lording over the fact that he has got the fear toxin in all of the super friends and they're all surrounding him? What do you think of this as an image?
So, I happen to love the Scarecrow. I also happen to be a big fan of Kurt Schaffenberger. So, you know, I love this cover personally. I have to admit, I had forgotten that this comic existed, and you know, when you first asked me to do this, until I reread it. Mm-hmm. But it'd been many, many, many years since I'd read it. But you know, but it's great. You know, it's your favorite heroes fighting, you know, a fiendish villain. What could be better?
Yeah, I mean, I love, I always love it when the artist, whether it's Ramona Fraiden or Kurt Schaffenberger, who of course is filling in here, finds a way to get all the characters onto the cover. That's mm-hmm. hard to do because you've got, you know, seven mm-hmm. heroes plus maybe a villain. But here, you know, part of it is just the work of just drawing seven to eight figures is more work than, say, two or three. Mm-hmm. But here you've got everybody. And I really love the pose that Batman is doing. It's very Batman Mysterioso kind of thing. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. the Super Friends Batman was obviously much more kid friendly, but this one is right out of, like, you know, the early 40s with the cape draped over it. It looks really cool.
Yeah.
I always love it. Except the Scarecrow is in the center there, just lording it over everybody. He says, "Come on, Super Friends, aren't you going to stop me from stealing this loot?" And Aquaman is the one speaking, and he says, "He knows we can't. He's paralyzed us with fear." So yeah, good luck not spending 40 cents on this, kids, if you saw this. So, okay, the plot synopsis, as I said, it's called The Scarecrow Fights with Fear. It's by E. Nelson Bridwell, of course, and Kurt Schaffenberger and Bob Smith. The Super Friends are on stage getting an award for public service funded by the reclusive millionaire Stephen Wilde, who has recently moved to Gotham. A photographer asks Superman if they can pose for some pics at the Hall of Justice, which the Man of Steel agrees to. The photo has all of the Super Friends pose for the pic, except for Gleek, who is hanging in the background. The camera goes off with a blinding flash of light. Suddenly, all the Super Friends awards turn to smoke. As it clears, they see the photographer is actually the Scarecrow. Revealing he is also the mysterious Stephen Wilde, he tells the Super Friends that the plaques were designed to dissolve when the special camera bulb went off. He then throws the camera at Wonder Woman, who is suddenly deathly afraid of metal. She ducks out of the way, desperate to remove her bracelets and tiara, which are, of course, made of metal, too. Robin becomes terrified of bats, a definite problem for the sidekick of Batman. Even worse, Aquaman is now afraid of water, and he cowardly ducks out of the way of a common water pistol. Batman gives chase, but stops dead in his tracks when the Scarecrow makes it outside. The Batman is now afraid of the dark. Only Superman is left, but he is left watching the Scarecrow take off in a helicopter because the Man of Steel is not afraid of heights. Finally, even the Wonder Twins are left helpless, afraid of each other, meaning they can't trigger their powers. Flying high, literally and figuratively, the Scarecrow tells his henchmen that their next job will mean big money, namely robbing the home of millionaire Bruce Wayne. The trouble alert goes off, telling the Super Friends that the Scarecrow has landed outside Bruce Wayne's penthouse. Batman wants to give chase, of course, but the thought of going outside terrifies him. Superman solves this by giving his pal a light tap on the head, knocking him out. All the Super Friends find a way to get around their various phobias and head to Wayne Foundation's building. Wonder Woman grabs Aquaman and carries him to the roof, but he can't cross the rooftop pool to go inside. No problem, Wonder Woman promises. She'll bring the Scarecrow out to him. Her fury overriding her fear of the metal bullets being fired at her, Wonder Woman grabs the Scarecrow and brings him outside. Wonder Woman is about to throw him off the roof when Scarecrow tells them he'll give them the antidote to his fear toxin. He sets it off and then uses the resultant smoke to escape. Waiting for him, though, is Robin, who used a secret elevator that, of course, only Wayne's ward Dick Grayson would know about. The Scarecrow throws all subtlety out the door and straight up tries to strangle the Boy Wonder underwater. Batman stops him, but the Scarecrow almost pushes Batman off the roof. Robin, still afraid of bats, somehow musters up the courage to tackle Dr. Crane and save Batman. The tackle pushes Scarecrow off the roof, but Superman conquers his fear and takes off, saving the Scarecrow's life in midair. Back at the Hall of Justice, everyone is back to normal except for the Wonder Twins, who are still scared to touch. Suddenly, Gleek grabs them both with his tail, bumping them together, forcing them to change form. That ends the phobia, and Aquaman says that it was he who telepathically asked Gleek to help the Wonder Twins get over their fear. Okay. As I said before we were on air, everybody, I feel so bad that these synopses are so long. But E. Nelson Bridwell managed to pack more story into 17 pages than any trade paperback basically nowadays, man, just to get in. The man just really gave kids a value for their money. So, you know, as we normally do, we'll kind of go through the scenes as they go through. But overall, what did you think of this issue, rereading it after such a long time, Charlie?
Well, so, I mean, I have reactions on a couple of different levels. One is, you know, nobody had a more encyclopedic knowledge of DC history than Nelson Bridwell.
Right.
And so, you know, the fact that he brings in bits of like really old Wonder Woman lore about how her bracelets actually keep Amazons from going insane, essentially.
Yeah, was that a thing? I didn't
know. Yeah. That's an actual thing.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
It's Nelson Bridwell, man. He does not mess around with this stuff. So, you know, between that kind of stuff, which, you know, I also happen to really love playing with, so, you know, I'm always very happy to see other people doing it too. You know, there's a lot of stuff in here like that. Now, the other part of my reaction, though, and again, as I say, I had completely forgotten this story because I hadn't read it in probably 40 years when you asked me about this. And when I reread it, my other reaction was a bit of chagrin because I didn't realize just how much overlap there was between this Super Friends story with the Scarecrow and the one that I did in my Super Friends series, where, you know, I did a Halloween issue with the Scarecrow, and it was also the Scarecrow using, you know, his fear gas to give all the Super Friends phobias. And some of them were the same phobias and some were not, actually. So, you know, hydrophobia for Aquaman just seems obvious. And, you know, giving Batman a fear of the dark and Superman a fear of heights. I am pleased to say, though, that some of mine were different. I actually gave Wonder Woman linonophobia, which is a fear of string, so she couldn't use her magic lasso. and because I had the Flash and Green Lantern, I had Green Lantern with a fear of light and Flash with, what's it called, tachyophobia, I think, fear of speed. And so, and the resolutions are different and all of that, but notwithstanding, you know, I got to those pages in here. I thought, wish I had remembered that at the time. I probably would have written a different story.
But they might stick alike, Charlie. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, I mean,
you know what? I could be in worse company than Nelson Bridwell.
So. Yeah. I mean, good Lord. I mean, aren't 99.9% of the Scarecrow stories him giving the hero the heavy weapon? That's his MO. That's his thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? I mean, again, Aquaman being afraid of water. What else are you going to do? I mean, what other fear? If you wrote the Scarecrow giving Aquaman a different fear, you'd be like, what the hell's wrong with the Scarecrow? Like, you know, the Aquaman thing's right, the water thing's right there. Jonathan Crane, what are you talking about? So yeah, right. I mean, it's kind of like, okay. So I love the opening scene of the Super Friends getting like a public service award. Cause you know, I do love this era of the Super Friends of, you know, they are the friends to everybody. They are not mysterious. They are not, the creepy overlords that kind of superheroes have become a little. I like that and everyone shows up. There's this big award ceremony. I absolutely love the line, on page 2, where Batman and Robin and the Wonder Twins walk off stage while the other guys are getting applause, and they talk about this Steven Wilde guy who just moved to Gotham, and Robin says, "What bothers me is why is he so secretive? Where he got his money?" And Batman goes, "It is suspicious, Robin. We talk about the pot calling the kettle navy blue. I mean, what are you talking about, Batman?" Like, isn't Bruce Wayne the most mysterious? Like, what? Like, maybe he's got some secrets like you do, Bruce. I just thought that line just jumped out of me. I'm like, wow, he's really not, he's really understanding his Bruce Wayne's perception in Gotham City at this point.
Yeah.
So, and then so that we meet this photographer who, of course, if you know the Scarecrow, you can guess is, you know, Jonathan Crane, because he has this kind of gaunt look. Right. You know, he has this kind of slightly Anton LaVey beard going on. So, I mean, again, if you know the Scarecrow, you're like, oh, wait, I know that's going to be the Scarecrow. But, you know, I will say the Scarecrow has always been one of my favorite Bat-villains. I always felt mm-hmm. that he was underutilized as one of the best villains. Like, he never showed up on the TV series. It wasn't until, you know, Christopher Nolan put him in all three of the movies that I thought he started getting his due. But I always thought between his power set, his origin story, his look, and how well he matches Batman, I've always considered Scarecrow like a top tier Batman villain. How do you feel about it?
No, I agree. And I would add to that personally that, you know, because apart from doing comics, I've got a PhD in developmental psychology. I've had a Scarecrow story on the back of my head for years that I'm just waiting for a chance to do. But yeah, so he's always had a soft spot in my heart, even if it weren't for the fact that I just really like the character a lot, just because we sort of kind of share a vocation. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't find a lot of insane psychologist characters. So
yeah. Oh yeah. I always thought he was just so cool. So he sets off the flashbulb, and then the flashbulb causes the plaques to turn into smoke, which fills the Super Friends with the fear toxin. And then of course everyone starts realizing, you know, Robin starts cowering in a corner because he's terrified of Batman. And then Aquaman charges Scarecrow, and Scarecrow fires a water pistol at him to duck him out of the way, which I love the idea that the Scarecrow brought the water pistol just for this gag. You know, he had no other reason to bring a water pistol.
What makes you think he doesn't carry one all the time?
That's true. I don't know. I mean, I haven't read every Scarecrow story, but I just thought that was funny. It was kind of like, you know, he went, like, I'm imagining he's putting together this crime, this caper, and then the last thing is, like, he stops at a toy store, you know, for, like, a 75 cent, can I have a water, you know, they're like, okay, all right, yeah, whatever, you know, this is Gotham City. There's another great Batman piece of dialogue on page 5 where after Aquaman ducks out of the way, Superman says, hydrophobia, a morbid fear of water. And Batman says, Superman, you can stand around talking psychology, but I'm going to go put the scare of my own into the Scarecrow, which is kind of like, slightly kind of a dickish thing to say to Superman. I thought for a moment, like, wait, did the Scarecrow turn Batman into, you know, like he lost, you know, did he lose his manners or something? But no, he's just insulting Superman. So, okay, that's fine. That's the way that is. And then he chases the Scarecrow out into the night. And of course, he's terrified of the outside, cause he can't get, you know, then he's like, oh, we see that it's turned night at this point. And he's terrified. And Kurt Saffenberger does a great job, on the artwork. I mean, he always does just in general. Mm-hmm. And then especially when he's filling in for, Ramona Fraiden here, but I love Batman on his knees with his face covered over his, like he's embarrassed that this has happened to him. It's a great piece of, like, sort of, you know, physical, you know, characteristic, not using the face, but using the body language to convey how terrifying this is for Batman.
Yeah.
What do you, said you love Kurt Schaffenberger.
I do.
Mean, okay. I mean, so, did you grow up with him on Lois Lane and stuff?
Well, yeah, but I am a huge original Captain Marvel fan. And I actually, among the stuff in my collection, I have a couple of Kurt Schaffenberger Captain Marvel pages.
Really?
That are just gorgeous. Yeah. I met him. I actually met him 1988. They did a 50th anniversary of Superman convention in Cleveland, where Siegel and Shuster were from. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine and I made the trek out because, you know, how often are you going to get to do that? And I remember us squealing like small children when we discovered that it was my friend James Fry, who's a comic book penciler, when we discovered that James's table in Artist Alley was next to Kurt Schaffenberger.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, so it was, that was just wonderful. And I bought a couple pieces of art from him. So
wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. Except I love Ramon and Freyden. Part of the reason I love the comic is that it's Ramon and Freyden. But if you're going to get a fill-in, Kurt Schaffenberger
is a perfect choice.
Perfect choice. You know, yeah. I mean, it's incredibly solid work. And Bob Smith, I feel like underrated anchor. I feel like he was just absolutely perfect on both these artists. Like, really clean line, wonderful kid, perfectly kid-friendly work, but not, kind of cutesy. Like, they feel like real people with real weight and stuff like that. The page on page 7 after the Scarecrow's gotten away, and we have the angry Wonder Woman where she's standing there, and Batman's like, Wonder Woman has no restraints. She could run wild at any moment. And I love the way he draws her. She's kind of just standing there with her fists down, where she's like, like that. And then the next panel is Aquaman, once again, stricken with absolute terror that he cannot deal with water, because, of course, at this point, he still had the weakness of that. If he needs to get water every hour, he's going to die. So once again, it's like, with minimal line work, Kurt Schaffenberger conveys so much with just a couple of lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then he said the Scarecrow gets away on his giant helicopter, and he's lording it over everybody. He's lording it over the superfans. He's like, this is going to be this giant caper. I'm going to go after Bruce Wayne. And then Commissioner Gordon shows up and announces that, they're on the way to this penthouse, and we figure how are we going to, Superfriends, you got to handle this. And as I mentioned in the synopsis, I love Batman's like, criminals at my penthouse. This is a job for Batman. But I can't go there to stop them. It's dark outside. And then Superman just punches Batman's lights out.
Yeah, I know. You have to wonder a little bit about that.
Could there not have been a better way?
You know, it's sort of the old cure the amnesia by hitting him in the head route. But,
And his Superman but, you know,
maybe, maybe, maybe he was just getting back at him for that crack.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, I didn't forget about that, Bruce. I absolutely love, in the background of the panel, Gleek is doing the hands on the head thing, like he's doing like a Charles Nelson Reilly, like, he's just like, oh my lord, Superman punched Batman. Again, I love the idea of how Superman has to modulate his punch. Of course, just enough that he doesn't decapitate Batman.
Right, of course.
So this thing with Wonder Woman, that's a thing from her history? Because when I got to the story, I was like, when was that ever part of the character?
So I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember if originally, because this does go back, I think, to the 40s. Might be the 50s, but I think it was the 40s. I can't remember if it was the bracelets or if it was the Venus girdle, which was, the thing around her waist. Mm-hmm. But yeah, one of them basically keeps Amazons in check, and without it, they go into like a berserker rage.
I had no memory of that. I must have read a Wonder Woman comic that had that, but I had absolutely no memory of that. So I just thought it was, again, every one of these panels without her with her tiara on, Kurt Schaffenberger, she just looks angry, which is just fantastic. Another little detail that only I pay attention to, because of course Aquaman's my favorite character, is that you've got Superman, Robin, and Wonder Woman showing up at Wayne Foundation, and then Aquaman is bringing up the rear with Wonder Twins and the unconscious Batman. And you see the Batmobile arrive with Aquaman getting out of the driver's seat. And I like that Aquaman can drive the Batmobile. I love that the Batmobile isn't like security enabled that stop anybody from driving it.
Or even that Aquaman has a driver's license.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, how does he know how to get it? He might be like, what else is this thing? But I love the idea of Aquaman driving the Batmobile. So then Aquaman wants to get into the building to get Scarecrow, but he's being kind of a chicken, and Wonder Woman, of course, who is now full of rage, simply grabs him and runs up the side of the building in a marvelous silhouette panel as she runs straight up. And again, it's so much is done with so little. The silhouette panels, for a lot of artists can be cheats, because obviously it's the silhouette. You get it done really fast. But again, the body language is great, that Aquaman looks like a wet dish rag with Wonder Woman kind of like running up the side of the building. It's just a great little, again, piece of business that Schaffenberger throws into the story.
Yeah.
So they get to the top of the Wayne Foundation. And of course, Wayne Foundation has a moat, essentially, with a kind of bridge over it. And we've gone over this in other stories where the Wayne Foundation as a concept, as a building, is the most insane piece of architecture probably in the DC universe in terms of how it's built. And that you've got an office that only exists on the frame of the building with a giant tree in the middle. Like, it's just like, it makes no sense on an architectural level, but it looks cool.
And it allows you a place for the secret elevator, which exactly. goes through the tree.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So then Wonder Woman attacks Scarecrow. There's a marvelous panel. And some of these pages will be on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, where they're firing at Wonder Woman and she is popping out of the frame. Like her legs are popping out into the next panel and she's charging at them, which again, she looks absolutely enraged. Again, it's just absolutely marvelous work by Schaffenberger. So then she bum rushes Scarecrow and Fireman carries him out of the building, which again is kind of humiliating. He's like, and then you've got Scarecrow even yelling, "Aquaman, save me!" And then she hangs him upside down. She grabs him by the feet and just dangles him. Just like really trying to humiliate him. And then getting so mad, she stands on the lip of the building and is ready to pitch him over the side, which is great.
Yep.
I mean, the Super Friends cartoon could never kill anybody except for that one episode where they did. At least in fake, but you know, in the comic, they could kind of edge towards that, but that, you know, it was still considered a kid's book. They really couldn't get into anybody dying. Was that a restriction you guys had on your book that your death was just
On my Super Friends?
Yeah.
Oh, on my, well, so my Super Friends, because it was really designed as like my first superhero kind of thing for very young kids. We couldn't have anybody hit anybody.
Really? You didn't have anybody hit anybody in that book? I read every issue. I'm
29 issues, there is not a single punch thrown.
Wow.
And while that's a little bit restrictive, it forced me to be more creative. So, you know, we had a lot of lassoing. We had a lot of super breath. We had a lot of, you know, power ring stuff. We had a lot of, you know, whipping up tornadoes, you know. But no, nobody ever hit anybody because we could not do any imitatable violence.
Gotcha. Okay. So you could do, you know, giant green catcher's mitts, you know. But
exactly. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
That's great. All right. I can't say I ever really noticed because I said I bought that series when it came out. I bought every single issue.
Yeah.
Speaking of violence, though, of course, Scarecrow tackles Robin and then just straight up tries to drown him. Like there's no cleverness. There's no fear toxin. It's just now. And there's this marvelous panel of the Scarecrow just, you know, kneeling over Robin. Well, Robin's got his head dunked underwater. It's, again, it's Kurt Schaffenberger, so it's got a gentleness that, you know, kind of the non-kid-friendly artist would have done. It's not like you're going to get, like, Marshall Rogers drawing this or something, or Dick Dillon. But it's about as violent an image as you're going to get in a Super Friends book of Robin just being drowned by the Scarecrow.
Right. Well, I think they did that intentionally, though, because, because the idea was put it in such an extreme situation that Batman has to break through the phobia.
Right.
But yes, it's a little bit surprising in a Super Friends. Yeah.
It really is. Great to wait. He's like, he's got his knees around him. He's just drowning poor Robin. So then, again, you say Batman gets through. That's enough to shake Batman out of his sort of stupor. And then he reverses the effect when Scarecrow is about to push Batman off the roof. And Robin, again, a great panel of Robin looking forlorn with his brow filled with sweat. And he finally is like, I'm terrified of bats, but I have to say Batman. And he just sort of covers his eyes and tackles Scarecrow in the midsection, which accidentally knocks Scarecrow off the roof. And then Superman catches him and, you know, gets over his fear of flying and catches Scarecrow in mid-fall. And, you know, and even says, that's poetic justice for you. I kind of do that Danny Dark voice when I think of Superman in this comic. So then back at the Hall of Justice, of course, the Wonder Twins are still stuck because they can't touch each other, and that's the only way they get their powers. And then we get Gleek, as I say, slaps them together, forces them together, and we see that Aquaman is the one who says, hey, I told Gleek to do it, which is sort of gets into his telepathic powers. And I always love it when writers would expand Aquaman's abilities, because of course at this time Aquaman was only, you know, talk to sea life, but you know, E. Nelson Bridwell was like, no, Aquaman could telepathically talk to anybody, including space monkeys. So Aquaman doesn't get a ton to do in this story, but I'm glad he kind of gets the final moment in the adventure. So two of the things I like to go over as we summarize these stories is I like to nominate or give an award to the best friend, as I call it, which is the character that comes off the best. So of the heroes, which one, Charlie, do you think probably, you know, I think this is a pretty equal story.
Yeah, that's a tough question here. Yeah, because, I mean, they're all, I don't know, does somebody come off better than the others in this one? I don't know.
Some stories, it's very heavy. I mean, a couple issues ago, Aquaman was sort of took center stage. This one is pretty equal. I will say my nomination is Robin. I feel like Robin gets kind of the big moment where that big close-up where he's, you know, oh my God, Batman, I have to save him. And that's what does it's Robin by a hair. I would say this is a fairly
equal. Okay. Issue. I would give you that.
Fair enough.
And then, you know, Wonder Woman is clearly the one who stands out, but not for that reason.
right. I mean, her berserker rage is fantastic. I mean, I just love that. She's just going to grab Scarecrow, carry him under her arm, and then just throw him off the roof. That's it. Done. Like, okay. Wow. She's really Batmaning it up here. And then the other thing I always like to talk about, the villain, because generally, E. Nelson Bridwell was creating new villains or alien races or whatever, most of which never made it out of the Super Friends. They would kind of appear in this book and then never again. Obviously, in this case, that's not the case. Scarecrow is a classic Batman villain, and he's using it here. So Scarecrow, this is just one stop among many for the Scarecrow in the DC universe. So we talked a little bit about the Scarecrow, you know, his power set and everything else. And you said you wrote him in a story, and you said he's kind of one of your favorites. So you said this, you have this idea for a story. Did you just come up with that? I mean, were you trying to write something, or was it just when you were working on something else?
Oh no, I've had that for years because of, well, without giving too much away, because I may still someday get the chance to write the story, but, no, it came from a psych class actually. And theories about the nature of emotion and that sort of stuff. So, I kind of understand in a different way than most people how the Scarecrow's fear toxin works and kind of building off of that. But maybe someday, you never know, because I have various stories that I thought I would never get to write that eventually I got to write. So, you know, you may see it someday.
Did you ever work? I read them all as well, but I don't remember. Did you ever work Scarecrow into Scooby-Doo team up?
Yes. He was the villain in number 2, which was the Ace of the Bat Hound team up. And the Scarecrow's fear toxin apparently does not work on dogs. So while Batman and Robin and everybody were busy fighting an imaginary monster, it was up to Scooby and Ace to go catch the Scarecrow.
Perfect. Yeah.
That's great. It's a little known fact that his fear toxin doesn't work on dogs, by the way.
There you go. Okay. So I do want to ask you again a little bit about writing DC Super Friends, because as I said, you wrote every single issue. Now, was this something pitched to you? I assume it was.
Super Friends?
Yeah.
So here's what happened basically. So, you know, there was a Super Friends toy line.
Right, the Imaginext stuff, right?
Exactly. Right. And at that time, you know, I'd been writing for the DC Kid books for a while, but I had recently done an issue of Justice League Unlimited. And Rachel Gluckstern, who was my editor on a whole bunch of stuff, but including that, was then asked to edit Super Friends. So she thought of me because, you know, we work well together. I happen to love working with Rachel. Even now she's working for, there's a gaming company that is doing some digital comics with some of their characters, and she's editing that stuff. So I've been doing some stories for that. But at that time, because, you know, since I had just done the Justice League Unlimited, she was able to go to the folks in charge and say, well, what about Charlie doing this? So I thought, you know, that this was going to wind up being like a toy book, and that they were going to want us to be plugging the toys and all of the stuff and all of that. And Rachel and I had a meeting with Dan DiDio, who was publisher at the time, and Jan Jones, who is sort of his second in command at that point, to talk about the series. And to my very pleasant surprise, Dan said in no uncertain terms that they absolutely did not want us to do that. They did not want this to be a toy book that was just plugging all this stuff and whatever. And the real idea behind it was, you know, like I said before, it's like my first superhero, basically. Doing this for kids who are just learning to read or who couldn't read yet and were having comics read to them, but introducing them to these characters and whatever. And so I approached the series basically like I was writing Silver Age Justice League, but aged down a bit. And so it gave me the excuse to write all of these characters. Cause like I said, the first comic I ever read was Justice League of America number 62. And I still have my copy of it.
The thing with the mysterious mailbox.
That's the one. Panic from a Black Mailbox.
There you go. The cover with all the JLAers looking in the mailbox. I remember that.
Exactly. Wow. I'm very impressed. Good job. Yes. And actually, I remember at the time, you know, commenting to my mother that it was so funny because it was Panic from a Black Mailbox and the box was red. And then she explained to me what blackmail was. So it gave me the opportunity to write pretty much every classic Justice League villain, to do, you know, pastiches of stories and stuff like that. You know, I did Felix Faust with the whole Justice Leaguers on its fingertips thing, and then I made the activity in that issue finger puppets of the Justice League. And they really just kind of gave me an enormous amount of freedom. And so I said, okay, I want to put, you know, a puzzle page in each one of these, and I want to put a cutout activity in each of these. And they said, okay, great. And I said, okay, and I want to, on the letters page, I want to encourage kids to be doing stuff. And so I really want to do the super friend of the month, where a kid writes in with something nice they did for somebody, them being a super friend. And they said, great. And we did that. And I said, and I want to put a secret code in it. And they said, great. And I did that. You know, and Rachel is wonderful. Rachel's the sort of editor that when I said, okay, I want to put Batmite in this, she said, okay, why don't you put Mr. Mix's Piddalick in there too? You know, so it was just an enormously fun series. And what I found was that, you know, kids loved the book. There was actually, when it got canceled, I saw a thing online. Some father had this blog where he posted this thing, and the headline on it was something like, Dan DiDio just made my 5-year-old cry. And it was all about how the kid was so upset about Super Friends ending. So I sent the kid a note in Super Friends code.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Yeah. But, you know, it was enormous fun. And so for people, adult readers who didn't get it, they said, oh, it's a toy book. Oh, it's just written for little kids. But for adult readers who got it, much like you, they realized what I was doing with it.
Yeah.
Realized that it was like, you know, just doing Silver Age Justice League and just playing, having fun with it. And so, you know, I loved that book.
It always frustrated me that you know, comic book companies, either Marvel or DC or whoever, would do these books for kids and then kind of never make a whole lot of attempts, it seemed to me from the outside, to kind of get them where little kids were, because like they were only selling them in comic shops, and little kids generally don't go to comic shops. You know, it's like if you're trying to aim these books at a much younger audience, you got to go where those kids are to see them.
Yeah, it was a frustration for me too, honestly. And so I would try to do things like, because I had spent years at that point working for people like, you know, Children's Television Workshop, where they're making Sesame Street and stuff like that. I had friends who, you know, worked on parenting magazines and things. And so, you know, so I went to friends of mine and said, hey, could you put like a little plug for this in here? Because I think parents would really want to get it for their kids. But they just didn't know how to market it, honestly, in that respect. And, you know, and that's why nowadays much of DC's kid stuff has sort of migrated over to graphic novels. And in some ways it's a shame because it means that you have to spend the money on an entire graphic novel to try something out. But on the other hand, it means that this stuff is showing up on the shelves in the kids section of bookstores, right. You know, and so that way it can actually find its audience a little better. So, you know, like everything, it's pluses and minuses. But
yeah, I know that getting in the real estate, the supermarket real estate, is impossible to get into, and it's incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. And Archie pretty much has it lock, stock, and barrel. But I always imagine, even when you were doing the book, that would have been a great digest to, you know, like collect three of them and put it in the supermarket rack, and that's for little kids, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And you had some amazing artists on there. Like Jay Bone, I remember, did a bunch of stories.
Yeah.
I mean, really beautiful.
Yeah.
Dario, who was the other? I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the other.
The big ones, or the ones who, you know, were most frequent, Dario Brizuela.
Yeah, that's the one name I was thinking of.
And Stuart McKinney.
Yes, Stuart McKinney.
And Jay Bone would do the covers, and then sometimes he would do the insides. Sometimes it was because it was like a, whatever it was, you know, a certain issue number, it was a big issue or something. And sometimes it was just because, like, J-Bone really likes Bizarros. So when I did the Bizarro Super Friends, he lobbied to draw that issue. But yeah, we actually, you know, the funny thing is, so Dario lives in Argentina. Stuart's in Australia, and Jay is in Canada. And
international,
so,
global guardians.
It was, yeah, very much global guardians. But as a result, while the book was running, I met Dario a few times because he would come up to the States once a year for the New York Con. But during the time we wrote we did the book, I had never met Jay and I had never met Stuart in person. We all, you know, like exchanged emails and stuff, but that was about it. And then, I think it was the year after the book was canceled. Jay and Stuart both came to the New York Con, and for the first time, we actually were all in the same place at the same time, which was really nice.
Oh, that's great.
It's the way of the world these days. So many people that you work with, you just never even meet in person because, you know, they're on the other side of the world or something.
Yeah. I mean, I said I bought every issue of the book partly because I genuinely enjoyed it. It was Silver Age, but it was also at the time it was the only place you could find classic Aquaman because he was dead in the current continuity. You were the only guy writing Aquaman at the time. Yeah. So.
No, I remember that's how we first met.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so Aquaman brings people together. It was a fine follow up to this series, and I wish that the Super Friends brand was just something DC was interested in keeping going in perpetuity, because I think it's still a brand that kids know. I mean, it's a name that you still kind of know.
Well, never say never.
Yeah, all right, maybe so. Maybe someday you'll get to do your scarecrow story for that or something.
Yeah.
So as we're wrapping up here, I do want you to mention one of your current gigs, which is another overlap with my history in terms of where you are teaching right now.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so right. So in addition to – I'm writing a whole bunch of stuff right now. I've got – let's see, what do I have coming out? Oh, so they actually just announced it this week, so I can say it publicly, that we're doing a second series of Batman Scooby-Doo Mysteries.
Yay!
So the first series, I kind of alternated issues with Ivan Cohen writing this time around. Again, because DC isn't doing as many kid comics these days, we have to spread the wealth a little bit. So Ivan and I are each writing four issues, and a couple of other writers are each writing a couple. But that's coming out. There's another series that the first issue just came out from Dynamite. It's a four-issue limited series of Mad Bulls versus Garbage Pail Kids, if you remember either of those.
I do. I remember both those things.
So that's out right now too. There's I have a middle school Batman graphic novel coming out next month. That's actually, I'm really looking forward to, called Batman's Mystery Casebook, which is a bunch of solve it yourself mysteries that let you, you know, kind of match wits with the world's greatest detective to try to solve the mysteries before he does. And various other bits and pieces of stuff. But as you say, I'm also, for the last couple of years, basically like throughout the pandemic, I've been intermittently teaching a comics writing class for the Kubert School online. So we've just started up a new semester of that, with a new crop of students, which is a whole lot of fun. And yeah, so, you know, and that's all apart from my day job doing like educational TV and stuff like that. So it's a busy time, but it's all good stuff.
You are busy, man. That is a lot of things going on. Yeah. My goodness. So yeah, I mean, said I would have killed to have someone like you writing, teach. Well, they didn't even really teach writing much at all when I was at the Kubert School. So that school, that's great that they're doing it now. And that's awesome that you're getting to, you know, I would have loved to take that course. That would be super.
Well, cool, you still can.
I think my days at the Kubert School are long past now, Charlie. So who's the old guy? Well, again, awesome. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I always wanted to have you on ever since I started the show, just because you have such a strong connection with the Super Friends as a sort of a brand. And yeah. So I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this. So thank you so much for coming by.
Oh, thanks for asking me. It's fun.
No problem at all. So, okay, everybody, stay tuned. I'm going to run some commercial announcements. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
And the hideous scarecrow.
This is Stratego. Not a place, not a time, but a battle of wit and skill and strategy. Stratego, we're generals. Field marshals, scouts and lieutenants, miners and spies all conspire with bombs and brains to capture the enemy flag, to win the battle, to win the game. Get Stratego from Milton Bradley. Victory awaits you.
Do you remember your first comic book? Do you remember the first time you held a cover in your hand and you flipped the pages? You read the adventures of these amazing heroes and you really fell in love with the medium? The first time you bonded a character to a team, to a company, and you knew, yep, I'm in this for life. Well, so do we. So join us on the never-ending reading pile from the Pulp to Pixel podcast network, where we proudly don our nostalgia goggles. We dive into our favorite comics, our favorite eras, our favorite characters, our favorite creators, and we just bask in the glory that is being a comic book collector. Come join us and help us chip away at the never-ending reading pile.
And it's time for listener feedback. And these are the comments we got from the website, FrontwaterPodcast.com. On our last episode, episode 31, with special guest Dr. Ange. First up is Isamu Hideki Yuginori, who says, Black Orchid, perhaps I have special ways of defending myself. Like, say, a force field, like the one she projected over the kryptonite in the museum. It's as if Black Orchid had, oh, I don't know, a force-filled belt created by a green-skinned intelligent hero from 10 centuries in the future, which may have been a gift during one of his dates with a certain time-traveling Kryptonian, ... Good theory, Isamu. Next up is Edo Boznar, who says, you know, I think at this point, resistance, as a certain race of cyborgs would say, is futile. That award is going to be called the Robbie, whether you like it or not. Edo, I think you're probably right about that. Rob McCarthy says, one, since Earth Super Friends had a Superboy, maybe a very young Lex Luthor turned on a machine to actively attract kryptonite, or two, better yet, Luthor makes fake kryptonite and sells it. Yeah, it's like those 70s ads where you could buy the big hunk of kryptonite. I bought one of those. Matt Saroy says, hey, Superman, if that kryptonite seems to kill Black Orchid, maybe she should stop holding it over her head. Just a suggestion. Thanks for another fun installment of For All Mankind. I look forward to each monthly episode the way I did for my comic book subscription to come in the mail when I was a kid. I have no idea what the next issue will be about. I know it will be fun and entertaining. And as you mentioned during the episode, most of us love the Legion of Doom episodes of the cartoon. I personally have to say that I'm glad they left it behind. It was great, and they are my favorite episodes, but it did get repetitive. Changing it up allowed them to give us more villains from the comics like Gentleman Ghost and Darkseid. New Interpoof classic monsters. I don't know if that's a typo or some sort of weird autocorrect. So please, Matt, let me know what Interpoof might mean. Interpoof classic monsters like Frankenstein and Dracula, as well as all kinds of weird alien races and disasters. Not to mention the classic Universe of Evil episode. That's just my opinion. As far as the name for the award, I suggest the 5-star co-host award. I like it, Matt, but as Edo says, it's probably going to end up being the Robbie. Chris Franklin from our network, and of course was on that very episode, says, great episode, gents. Always a pleasure to hear from Dr. Ange. I never knew much about Black Orchid, first encountering the cover for first appearance in an issue of Comic Collector magazine in the early 80s, pre-Who's Who. I had no idea there was a Supergirl Black Orchid fan theory. I guess it makes sense if you assume Kara wanted to prove she could shine on her own as a hero, out from the shadow of her more famous cousin, someone like her Earth 2 counterpart Power Girl, but even more removed from their Kryptonian legacy. Or you could retcon that as an amnesiac character went through something similar to what caused the post-crisis Superman to unknowingly assume the guise of Gangbuster for a bit. I have never read this particular issue. My Super Friends collection is still incomplete, and I need those hardcovers, but now I want to. I always liked the Orchid's design. Despite being covered from head to toe, I think it's a very sexy costume. Maybe because the form-fitting purple reminds me of Yvonne Craig's Batgirl costume. I miss Bob Smith's inks here too, and what's with the thick white outlines about Batman and the twins on page one and fake black Orchid on page five? Was that a Jerry Serpy thing? It's pretty odd. As for the name of the award, how about the Superior Five Award, a backhanded reference to the Inferior Five, or Ultra, the multi-podcast guest award? I think that's my favorite suggestion of all so far, Chris, of course, because you know I love Ultra. But again, I think I just think inertia is going to take over and it's going to be to Robbie. But we'll fight the good fight. Martin Gray says, splendid episode. Could the host and guest be any better? Ange is the perfect person for this episode. I've been following his Black Orchid posts and they're fascinating. Congratulations to Ange on being the first Rob Kelly five-star spectacular. I bought this issue when it came out, knowing nothing about Black Orchid, and Ian B. made me want to know more. And what a great opening. I love Ian B. looking at the practical aspects of Batman getting around Gotham, things most of us never considered as kids. Batman is such an arse in that panel early on. Nice going, twins. I spotted it a moment before you did, but wanted to see if you also noticed it. Yeah, right. A quote, form of smog, unquote, feels appropriate for murky Gotham, and lo, it proved useful. I like that Superman has confidence that B.O., such an unfortunate set of initials that, will likely be able to sort things out by herself. That's a great line from Lisa. The Orchid will start to droop. Lisa is such the criminal mastermind. DC should have used her more, maybe made her a villain for all the DC ladies with strips. Supergirl, Wonder Woman, Lois, dot, dot, dot. It's a wonder that Superman didn't use X-ray vision to see who Black Orchid was. He had no compunctions in the 70s. Not like today when Wonder Girl Cassie Sandsmark frets about the morality of using X-ray vision. Yawn. As ever, Ramona's pencils were great. Shame Vinny didn't earn his paycheck. The only less than stellar art was Robin on the cover as he looked as big as bats. Nice for all merch kind section from Chris. Rob, I was confused by your comments about back issue and how you missed it and how it changed publishers. It's still coming out and from tomorrow's. I know that you know that because you're a contributor. Somewhere there is a stick and I have the wrong end. Martin, that's all my fault. I got all these things jumbled up in my brain. So let me clear this up. Yeah, as Isamu pointed out last episode, the Gorilla Grodd stuff was not in Amazing World DC Comics. It was in back issue. So that right there, I got that wrong. But when I mentioned back issue coming from Tomorrow's and saying that it was gone, I meant Comic Book Artist, which was a different magazine, which is now, I think, still being published from a different publisher, but it was, they ran about 25 issues of it from Tomorrow's. Those are the things I was thinking of. That was what I was thinking of about all instead of Amazing World of DC Comics. All this, I got it all jumbled up in my head. I'm old. I apologize. I still have all 25 issues of Comic Book Artist on my shelf as I'm sitting here. And there are two collections. If you have not read them and you love comics history, everybody, go get these. They are worth finding. You can find them on eBay, you know, pretty cheap. And then you can find some of the collections. They are just jam packed with fun interviews. And each issue was like a theme. They did two issues on like Charlton. They did an issue on Atlas Seaboard. They did National Lampoon and they did a horror comics. It was a really great magazine. I never missed them. So that's what I was thinking that, but saying back issue. So my apologies, everybody. All right. So let's move on. Cellar Dweller says, hello, super fans, and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Ange. We'll start with the cover, which, as you pointed out, featured all the characters, no one is missing, and no floating Wonder Twin heads. Always a plus. I'm surprised that first panel didn't get a lot of discussion. I thought it was a great shot of Batman training Zan and Jaina. Regarding the best friend, I would give it to Batman, not only for his work with the twins, but for figuring out the clue of the gem and the fake Black Orchid's flare. Like Ange, I liked the large panel of the fight and Zan and Jaina not using their XR powers, but rather showing off their training. Regarding his question about Jaina as a flying squirrel, in the comics, if the twins had changed shape, then wanted to take on other forms, they did indeed have to touch again. Black Orchid may not have had an action figure, but she has a pin. The company Fan Sets makes pins of DC heroes. I've collected a number of Super Friends characters, and they recently released one for Black Orchid. See you in the next podcast. Thank you, Chuck. I've never even heard of these Fan Set pins that you're talking about, so that's cool that Black Orchid got one. Little Russell Burbage says, I guess I'm in the minority in this issue, but although this was my first time reading about Black Orchid, the story didn't turn me into a fan. I would have liked a bit more of the actual origin or truth as to who she was, who or what she was. As Rob pointed out, this seemed like a Black Orchid story guest starring the Super Friends. She didn't grab me as an interesting character. I just didn't like her or the story. I'm sure I didn't care that Black Orchid never appeared anywhere else. I probably did expect to see her in The Brave and the Bold or DCCP, though. Odd that she never appeared in either of those books. Now, I did pick up the Black Orchid Vertigo series 10 years plus after this, and it was pretty weird yet entertaining. I don't see this Black Orchid as the same one as that one, though. That splash page of the Wonder Twins and Batman leaping across the gap between buildings has always been one of my favorite images. It's a shame that it's basically the best piece of art in the whole issue. Vince Coletta certainly was a hack. Jeez. As for the Super Adventure color forms, I happen to have a full set sitting right behind me as I write this. I remember seeing it at a Sears when I was youngster. I was a youngster. It went for the exorbitant price of $3.37, and I just didn't want it that badly. I was already old enough to not actually play with the color forms by that point, approximate 1975. I had my Mego action figures. However, it was still at the same Sears about a year later, so I finally did buy it and added it to my Aquaman collection. I have all the pieces and even the color pamphlet. If I knew how to post pictures to this page, I would. A year later and it was still sitting there. That is amazing. I love the idea that like there was this shelf of in the Sears toy section, which I used to haunt all the time because I remember Sears as well. But like no one touched it for a solid year that the color forms just sat there all this time collecting dust. That's amazing. I think nowadays the only toy sections I ever visit, not that I do anyway, are Target. Once in a while I'll wander down the action figure aisle. But like I feel like they're constantly changing. Like every couple of months you see like a whole different thing. So the idea that like there was one toy that just sat there for a year is just really funny to me. So I'm glad you picked it up because it's a marvelous set. So thank you, Russell. Sean M. Myers from our network says, welcome to the show, Dr. Ange. Looking forward to hearing you again in a few episodes. You were great. As the authority on Robin's thick thighs, listen to any episode of Batman Family Reunion for proof. I can certainly Robin that would indeed be able to catch that meteorite with his feet. Like most people here, that was my introduction to Black Orchid. After hearing Dr. Ange talk about her, I decided to read all of her previous appearances. But to add even more to her puzzling nature, none of those can be found on the DC Universe Infinite app. She really is mysterious. Sean Ross says, great episode. Dr. Ange's enthusiasm and expertise always makes for a great show. In mentioning Black Orchid's appearances, I'm not sure if you guys mentioned Blue Devil Annual Number 1. This is such a fun story. It contains the many origins of Black Orchid. It's my favorite story featuring the powerful B.O. I may want to reconsider that abbreviation. Thanks for the great show. Yes, Sean, I've certainly read the Blue Devil Annual. I know Shag loves it. I mean, he's a big Blue Devil fan. And it's a great one and done. It's a really wonderful, like, summer fun annual features. Great artwork and all the mystery characters. The reason I didn't mention it, and this is, you know, it's not like a hard and fast rule, but just like a general guide, more of a guideline than a rule, is it's post-crisis. And to me, the Super Friends, you know, like, they are firmly pre-crisis, obviously. I mean, they're really leaving their own thing. But to me, any comic post-crisis just has nothing to do with Super Friends. So I generally don't get into appearances or anything like that afterwards. So that's just kind of where my head is at. But yes, totally can vouch for that Blue Devil Annual. It's absolutely fantastic. So if you have not read it, anybody, and you like fun comics, check it out. Then Isamu is back, and he says, fun story review, Uncle Rob and Dr. Ange. It wasn't mentioned on the show, but Ange knows that the one case where Black Orchid reprogrammed the computer using x-rays happened in Phantom Stranger 36. Speaking of that, I pulled out my dad's Adventure Comics and Phantom Strangers to see if there was a printed reader letter that brought up the Supergirl fan theory. There wasn't. One that comes close is in Adventure 431, where letter writer Chip Bestler complained about the new Black Orchid feature, saying she is little more than a combination of Supergirl and the Phantom Stranger. I wonder if this prompted the idea to make Black Orchid a backup strip in the Phantom Stranger book when the Spectre took over the Adventure title. Another letter by Kurt Johnson in Adventure 432 mentioned that the removal of Supergirl from the pages of Adventure to star in her own series was a change for the better, and suggested Black Orchid be removed as well and be a backup in Supergirl. I have a feeling Kurt was happy to see the Spectre. And to be clear, there were more letters of praise for the Black Orchid feature than complaints. In response in Adventure 431, it said the reaction was running about 2-1 in favor of the strip. I like the idea of Black Orchid being a rogue reprogrammed Supergirl robot, maybe triggered by Earth's pollution, but a less disastrous result of what happened to the Superman robots. Once again, thank you, Isamu, for the information. Paul Ken from our network, of course, says, a great episode as usual, Rob. Great to hear Ange. Congrats on the Robbie. See, there it is. Like Ange, I've always been intrigued by Black Orchid. I don't know why, but she looks cool, and the mystery surrounding her is where the interest lies. I did not know about the Supergirl fan theory, but you can see how it makes sense. Thanks for that intel, Ange. And now I have to read the Black Origin posts on your blog. I laughed at your Batman Family Reunion call out with Robin throwing the boulder with his legs. Sean might disagree that he could do it. He loves to talk about thick thighs. Well, we already got to that, Paul. For all merch kind, color forms. Love them. And I think I had this one too. Good thing Vince Coletta didn't think the color forms box, it would have been blank. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that he didn't, because that artwork's pretty basic. Mark Baker Wright sends us a link, and he says, color forms apparently still exist. Who knew? And it's a link to a color form set from featuring Daniel Tiger, the PBS children's character. So that's really cool. That's great. I love that color forms still exist. Brett Young says, great show, Rob. I didn't have this issue as a kid, so it was new to me. I always liked the design for Black Orchid, even though I know nothing about her, except apparently she's not above fighting dirty like when she was Real Housewife Lisa on page 14. Another great group punch-out scene by Ramona at the end. Which henchman do you think caught the most crap in the paddy wagon? The guy who was slapped by Superman can't feel good about that dismissive smack, but the thug who was knocked out by Gleek's tail has got to be more humiliated by his buddies on the way to jail. And the guy Aquaman gut punched was most likely too busy barfing up his internal organs to care. I can't forget Robin catching the magic rock with his legs and whipping it back into the henchman. It seems impossible. Look, if you're going to choose to wear a green Speedo and show all your bare-shaven legs, you aren't skipping leg day. Good on you, Robin. I had a major nostalgia moment when I saw the image for the color form set. I had that as a kid and absolutely loved it. I do remember how lame the villains were, but who cares? I played that set until there was nothing left of it. What a great memory. Thanks, Robin, Chris. Thank you, as always, Brett. And then finally, Chuck Dill says, great show. I listened while sitting on the beach last week, hip deep in vacation. As much as I love the coverage of the Super Friends issues, I love it when Chris comes on to do For All Merch Kind. I have great memories of having the Super Friends color form sets as a kid. And about 10 years back, I reobtained the set at a convention. I'm only missing three of the really tiny pieces. And my set came with two of the color booklets. Good stuff. In fact, I think I'm going to go play with it now. That's amazing. You got two of the pamphlets. Maybe there's somebody out there who has a set with extra pieces and you could trade them or something. I don't know if you care that much about it, but I don't ever remember seeing the pamphlet. The set that I had for many years didn't come with it. So I'd love to see what that looks like. That's pretty cool. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for the feedback. I really appreciate it, as always. Big thanks to my pal Sholly Fish for coming by. It's so exciting to talk to Sholly. I'm such a big fan of his work, and it was so cool to finally have him on the show. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. So again, thanks to him for coming by and talking about this issue of Super Friends with me. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking Super Friends over on Twitter at ForAllMankindSF. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill, Stanford and Brown, Gord Tolton, and David Escutierrez for their support of the Fine Water Network. I really appreciate it. So as I said, that's going to do it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we will look at Super Friends number 33, The Secret of the Stolen Solitaire.
An FWTV podcast.